Teachers Teach in Books, a podcast all about the ways people teach, learn, and work with literature. I'm Jessica McDonald, and welcome back. Happy New Year, I guess, or just New Year without the happy. I'm not sure what the appropriate phrase is for years like these ones, but it is a new year and I am back. And on today's episode, I'm chatting with Tara Chambers. Tara is a sessional instructor for Thompson Rivers University's Department of English and TRU's Open Learning Division. And she's also a doctoral candidate at the University of Saskatchewan, where her research focuses on John Milton's Republican Poetics and the politics of Paradise Lost. But today we're chatting about something much different than that, a more contemporary novel that we've both taught called 15 Dogs by Andre Alexis. If you haven't read the novel, as usual, although I do think I forget to say this sometimes, whoops, sorry, here is your spoiler warning that we will indeed be talking about parts from the whole novel, including the ending. So spoilers to come, even right now in the next sentence. Parts of the novel, I want to let you know, deal with the deaths of animals, of dogs. So if you're not in a place to hear about animal or pet loss, then our conversation might not be the one for you to listen to today. Okay. When Tara and I get together, even over video apparently, we definitely chat up a storm. So this was quite an interesting interview to edit, and I hope that you enjoy our lively chat.
Okay, so anyways, whenever you're ready, I'm ready.
Okay. All right, well, you're ready, let's go. So yeah, why don't you just tell listeners a little bit about yourself or your work as an educator or anything that you want to say?
Well, I'm an instructor for the Department of English and Modern Languages at Thompson Rivers University here in Kamloops, British Columbia. Right now, because of the remote nature of teaching, I'm also an instructor for St. Thomas More College at the University of Saskatchewan, where we went to school together, and in Saskatoon. And I'm also an open learning faculty member for the English novel in the 18th century. And I'm also the course developer for open learning for a course that they want to offer coming up, Shakespeare and Contemporary Film.
Ooh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it is. So what it is Shakespeare and Contemporary Film, and I'm the way I'm scaffolding it is how Shakespeare, we are able to bend Shakespeare to contemporary issues.
Right.
Like using Romeo and Juliet, the Leonardo DiCaprio one, we really see that 90s generation, the MTV kind of generation throughout the whole Baz Luhrmann directorial extravaganza that is, right? So that's the way I'm trying to put it together, and hopefully it all works out.
Well, it sounds like trying to bend it to make it, I guess, I don't know if the word relevant is good to use here, but to make it relevant or sort of digestible for contemporary issues or contemporary audiences and readerships, that feels like a way to really get the fires lit under the asses of students who sometimes come dragging their feet to Shakespeare, right? And I know you do that anyways, because I see how you energize the students no matter what you teach. But yeah, I just feel like that's such a good way to make Shakespeare, which can come across as intimidating, more digestible for audiences or readerships or students that are not always comfortable with it for a good reason. The language can look scary upon first read, right?
So that's how I'm teaching this one at St. Thomas More. The first module is basically why Shakespeare's not scary, you know, and including, you know, Acala's rap to Shall I Compare Thee to a Summer's Day, you know, you have, because iambic pentameter, and showing them that this isn't, Shakespeare was writing for everyone. He wasn't writing for, everybody thinks he's writing for the upper classes, and he wasn't. He was writing for everyone. You got to think about those people that were on the floor who paid, you know, two pennies or whatever to go in and see those plays. That's who he was playing too. It's like going to the movies. The movies aren't just for fancy people.
I actually am realizing as you're talking, like, yes, we will have to have you back to talk about Shakespeare. Oh. Since A, you teach that, and B, that's, you know, more firmly in your area of expertise. Just to give some context, I guess, the reason why you're here talking about 15 dogs today, so not related to the kinds of things that you've just explained that you've been working on and that you have been doing for so long, is because I knew that you had taught this in the past. I had heard a little bit about how you taught it, and so I became interested in your teaching of it. Obviously, since we're friends as well, I thought I would ask you to speak about it. And I've taught this text a few times, so I thought this would be a good conversation. So yeah, do you want to say a few words about 15 dogs? Do you have any, like,
All I really had to say, because I did write out stuff, I'm like, oh my God, I should probably look through this again. I mean, the story starts out, you know, benign enough. We're in a Toronto bar, with two gods, two Hermes and Apollo, in a few human form. And they're debating whether or not human intelligence is a difficult gift or a useless plague. And they decide to wager a year of servitude that they will give the creatures, other than humans, this intelligence. And if the creature is happy at the end of its life, Hermes will, or I always say Hermes because I always think of the fancy store, will win the wager. In the end, they give it to 15 dogs. They get this higher order of thinking, 15 dogs that are stuck in a clinic, an overnight clinic, vet clinic. And then from this this point, it's just, I think the whole story is really interesting in that, are they gifted or are they cursed with human intelligence? Mm-hmm. You know, because they have to navigate the world. And the world is new now. This is not the world the dogs knew. And they have this new awareness as well. And some of the dogs are a little indifferent. Some embrace this new higher order of thinking, and some absolutely refuse to acknowledge it, right? They have to, you know, keep their dog thinking. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, what I think is really interesting is that the dogs have to navigate this new awareness in a park at first, and it's really interesting. And this is what I find fun is my sister, I used to go visit her in Toronto, and she lived exactly in this area. Hmm. So I could see it in my head, because it's close to Liberty Village around Lake Ontario in downtown Toronto. So the whole area, when I'm reading, I'm always like, I can see this. Oh my gosh, I know where this is. And so that's kind of interesting. Anyways, what more do you have to say about that's what I have to say, really.
Well, just on the last thing you said, I was thinking about how so many of the students I've taught this to, because I've taught this a few times now, they actually aren't familiar with this area or with Toronto. A lot of them aren't. A lot of them are sort of prairies born and raised. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the opposite experience of what you just described is something I've heard my students say, which is that they're unfamiliar with these streets. They're unfamiliar with this area. So your reading experience, which brings such, like, you're able to visualize the space and you're able to sort of read the book through that lens, the lens of your familiarity with it, is almost the opposite for students who are, in a lot of cases, really unfamiliar with this landscape. So the map at the front of the book, which, for any listeners who haven't read the book, you will have to go out and get a copy of it. But as this is a audio medium only, but the map at the very beginning of the book that shows the beach and High Park is instructive for some students, and it's helpful. But
actually, that's really interesting because we're probably going to get into that a little later on. I'm going to surprise you.
Ooh, okay, cool. So I'll just add a couple of things, just basically details to add to your summary, which is that we have you mentioned that dogs sort of respond to this big change, them being given human intelligence or human consciousness. They phrase it in a couple of different ways throughout the book. They respond in different ways. So we have a dog like Prince, for example, who really takes to the new ways, as they call them, the old ways and the new ways, or the canine and the human. And Prince starts, you know, playing with language in ways that he didn't before. He becomes a poet. He becomes a kind of artist figure. So he's reveling in the new ways. So then we have dogs like Atticus, who, as you mentioned, wants to really stick to the old ways and the canine, and sees the new ways as a sort of corruption of authentic doghood. Like, you're not being a real dog if you're going by the new ways. And by the way, for those who haven't read this book, what I mean by the new ways is they start to see the world differently. So they actually physically see the world differently in their perception. They see new colors. They experience empathy, like in one of the first moments after the gods grant them human intelligence or human consciousness. Atticus is dreaming and he dreams that he bites down on a creature's neck. And then he feels this sense that, oh no, this creature must feel pain. So they start to feel empathy. They start to use new language. They can speak more metaphorically. They start to question whether their old ways of being, like power hierarchies, mounting, that sort of thing. They start to question whether those are okay, whether they still make sense, whether they are still applicable to their new way of being. So that's what I mean by the old ways and the new ways. A dog like Atticus really wants to stick to those old ways. So he forbids the new language that the dogs start using once they have human consciousness thrust upon them. He wants to keep the pack hierarchy the same and still have the same protocols around like mounting and superiority and the leader, that sort of thing. And he essentially just forces all the other dogs to stick to dog ways. He says at one point in the novel, no ways but dog ways. So we have a real range from Prince to Atticus and everybody in between of how the dogs are dealing with this new human consciousness. And then by the end of the novel, sadly, spoiler alert.
Oh, God.
Yes. Should I say that? Spoiler alert.
It's
implied, right? I think it's implied. Like, you know it's going to happen. But by the end, yes, all the dogs have indeed died. And many of them do die miserably, which kind of factors into the bet that the two gods make, because they suggest that the dog has to be sort of happy upon the moment of death. So a lot of the dogs die miserably, like I said. And then some of them, or I should say one of them, Prince, actually dies happy because he's thinking about the beautiful language that he's been able to play with and that he's been able to sort of use since being given.
Oh, God, you're going to make me cry.
Oh, no. Okay, well, I actually had something to say about the feelings of this book, but I think that'll come out later.
Yep.
His very final thought, and this is what makes Prince's death a little bit more... it's emotional, certainly, and it's in the last pages of the novel. His very final thought is altered by Hermes. I also always want to say Hermes or something.
Hermes.
Like, yeah, Hermes. At the last moment, and his final thought is altered to be a memory of him running to his old master Kim in Alberta, who he loves and who he misses.
Oh, my God.
And the final line of the book is, in his final moment on Earth, Prince loved and knew that he was loved in return.
Oh my God, you're killing me.
And that's where the book closes. So I just wanted to emphasize that, you know, the dog's death sort of are the end of the book. Well, they die throughout the book, sadly. Yeah, but
from the very beginning.
Yeah, from the very beginning, they do die. But by the end, we sort of had that last moment with Prince that suggests that one dog did die happy, and that's important for the bet that the gods make.
Absolutely.
Yes, that's the book in a nutshell. So what kind of class did you teach this in? What was your sort of teaching context?
Well, this was actually, okay, so the first time this text, I experienced this text was when I was taking care of Dr. Cooley's seminar classes as his TA for a first year literature course at USASC. And these literature courses are a year long, as you know. So what he would do, and I know you've had to do it with him, like as well as me, like we've had to do this exercise. It was because the text was not my choice. It wasn't Dr. Cooley's choice, right? The assignment for at USASC is basically a research exercise for the students that they must find an award-winning or nominated novel and book, like depending on what your last name was, right? You have to find an award-winning novel or a nominated at least within the last 5 years and a book, like nonfiction and fiction. And then what they must do is read reviews and read some reviews about these novels. And then they have to nominate a novel that and a book that we read at the end of the semester, at the last part of the semester. There's the novel and the nonfiction. And of course, the TAs get to tally up all the votes. and the one that gets the most votes is the ones that the students are going to read, right? So, and I think students saw the word dogs in the title and decided that's what they wanted, to be honest, right? And so we ended up reading 15 dogs in that class. And then the second time I was course design, when I was hired here for summer session here in Kamloops, I was designing a course for introduction fiction for a summer class. And my theme was, I had to think up some theme quickly while I was still in Saskatchewan. And I'm thinking of short stories and I'm thinking of all this. And I'm thinking, what does it mean to be human, right? Mm. What does it mean to be a human or humanity? And so I was going to use Oryx and Crake, okay, because I've taught that quite a few times. I was talking to Dr. Cooley about it, and he advised me, you know, it's an awfully long novel for a compressed summer course, right? Because you just won't have time to get through. And I've taught Oryx and Crake since then. I taught it this last spring, and it is, I forgot how long it is. So I decided on 15 Dogs instead, and because it is much shorter than Oryx and Crake. And yeah, so that's where that's come in.
Great. I actually don't know if I knew the theme of your initial course, even though like I've heard of a few of the ways that you've taught this book, but the humanity theme that you're talking about, that's actually so applicable. And I didn't even know because I think the very first class, I didn't TA with this book, so it must have just been a different year. But the very first class that I ever incorporated this one into was when I first developed my nature versus culture class that has a unit on humans versus animals. And by the way, of course, when I say versus, I am totally complicating both of these oppositions, nature versus culture, human versus animal. But so I probably was thinking the same thing as you were when you initially developed that course, where I was thinking about this book in terms of what makes a human, or why, like, what definitions do we bring into humanity? So that's exactly what I was doing too, when I, and what I was thinking about when I put this novel in the unit on animals, like I said, animals versus humans in this first year English class. So very much similar, teaching situation to you that I've taught this in is every time it's either been a first year English class on nature versus culture, again, complicating that binary, or I've also the last time taught this in a unit, or sorry, a class on narrative, just reading narrative. So didn't really have a theme, but it was. So I guess your question, or the next question I had for you, was what leads you to teach this text? But you were sort of, because of Dr. Cooley's assignment, where he gets students to pick out the next or the last books to read in his course, you sort of were led into this book almost not by choice, but I kind of find that cool. It's like you were led into this book by students who, like you said, might have been attracted to the title 15 Dogs, because especially for dog lovers, who wouldn't be attracted to that title?
But yeah, much to their caution, really.
Totally, because in the end, as we just said, like, you know, it's a pretty sad tale. I know we know another instructor who finds it very hard to teach this text because of the deaths of dogs, which can be very beloved figures to some. So I just wanted to add in about the author a couple things. So Andre Alexis was born in Port of Spain, Trinidad. He grew up in Ottawa, Canada. So the way that I know Alexis is through Canadian literature, the literatures of Canada, which is what I primarily study. And he is often read under that category. The one thing I wanted to mention was that, especially because it's on the cover of the book, if you have like the edition that
I have exact same one
here. On the cover of the book, we see, and students see, that this is a book that's been widely applauded by the nation's sort of literary institutions. So it won the Scotiabank Giller Prize, the Rogers Writers Trust Fiction Prize, and it also won Canada Reads. So it won like 3 out of 4 really huge national literary awards. And that is an interesting conversation to have with students, because at least when I set it up, I always have already talked about sort of literary elitism and what kind of texts get valued and what kind of texts don't. So when I point out to them that these awards have been won by this text, I usually see them sort of nodding and get comments like, "Oh, that's why it was weird," or "That's why it was written weirdly." And it's true that we can sort of use that as a lens or a frame through which to read the book. It's like, why is this the kind of book to win Canadian literary awards? And what does the form of the book, including the prose style, how does that lead into it getting awards? So that's sort of a side tangent, but it's something that I wanted to make sure we said on the podcast, which is that it's a pretty, it's an award-winning book and written by a very sort of applauded author. Okay, so what do you focus on when you teach this text? What is, Yeah, what's the gist?
That's the thing. Because like I've said, I'm not, like, this isn't my area. But, you know, as we're teaching, and we have to, of course, teach in areas that we're not necessarily comfortable with, like I've done in this course. But sometimes you have to do that. I also made the mistake, and I made it again this year, of teaching Heart of Darkness, which I honestly, and one of the questions I ask my students is, should this novella never be taught ever again? Or is it important that we do read this and talk about it? Anyway, so what happened was, is that we have this theme, and as I was progressing, the novel was the final text. And so what I did is I had a couple of short stories that examined humanity from an artificial intelligence and from an animal angle. Before that, we did Ursula K. Le Guin, The Ones Who Walk Away from Olmus. Olmus? Okay. Have you read that?
Not, is that a short story? Okay,
it's a short story. It affected my students. Because what I was looking at was the idea of who is God. Because we have these two gods in 15 Dogs, and this is how I moved into it. But in these other stories, we have society playing God, we have corporations playing God, we have humans. Evil Robot Monkey, for example, is this poor monkey who is given human intelligence, and he's kept in a cage, right? And all he wants to do is make pottery, but he's always getting bugged, right? So like the idea of this, you know, who decides on the fate of people, of animals, and the idea of anthropomorphism, because we have that in Evil Robot Monkey. And I mean, like you were saying, you know, this is a storytelling device, right? We have to look back from ancient times with Aesop's fables and so forth. But, you know, we still imagine animals with human traits. Right. I mean, that's what we like to do. And it's interesting because I just graded an essay on Letitia Barbauld's The Mouse's Petition, as a matter of fact. It's an 19th century poem about, you know, animals should have rights, this poor mouse, and this is what he must be thinking. We don't know what the mouse is thinking, but we do this. So I was moving through it. Because with this idea of humanity, what is human? What is God? Like, where does this all fit in? Homo sapiens are merely a species, right? So who says we're the best? It's a species. We just walk bipedal, right? We're a mammal. And sometimes we use our reason, right? And so all of a sudden, you know, just because you're biologically human, how human are we, right? And if you ever read the Le Guin, Olmus, there's no the idea of empathy. Does empathy make us human? Mm-hmm. So, you know, and then we have this in 15 Dogs. So I was slowly trying to get my students into this mindset about the idea of what does it mean to be human? I mean, we read Heart of Darkness, and what we see is the worst of humanity, right? The worst humanity can ever, you know, be. We read The Ones Who Walk Away. You know, that is, you know, human beings who, it's a very short story. I do recommend people to read it, but there's so much to say about it. So I won't give it away. So I'm looking at who's God, what is God, who plays God. And we give these animals a human intelligence, right? We give them these human traits, these human emotions. And what do we actually learn about ourselves? And I think that's what Alexis was really going for, in a sense that, And the first thing I did with them is I put them in groups, and I got them to, you know, I gave them a dog, and they had to find out what kind of dog it was, find a picture of the dog, and then, you know, find what these dogs were good at, like the duck toller, you know, so like what are these dogs for, right?
Like in the real world. Some real world knowledge about these dogs that could help you read the characters of the dogs. Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And so they did that. But the thing was, they already started putting human traits on the dogs before we even were reading the story. And so it's just this automatic need to anthropomorphize an animal. And I think that was really interesting to watch. And then, of course, you know, if one creature is happy when they die, you know, Hermes wins, But what is happiness, right? And that's the question. Like you said, can we die happy and live a terrible life? Can we have a terrible life and in the end die happy? These are really big questions. And, you know, on a micro level, we looked at, and this is where I probably would get into you and where you would be more of an expert than me. And actually, I was thinking of you when I did this, because we were saying about the city of Toronto and the idea of space and place, right? And how both of these affect happiness and security.
I guess on just the last note, the space and place, maybe this is something you're going to talk about later, but do you involve the map? And if so, what do you say about it?
Well, no, I just make them to get familiar with the map, where we have the beach and High Park. And then we have High Park and the beach, and to look at that little inset of Toronto itself to see like there is actually, they do cover a lot of space, the animals.
Yeah. Okay. So similar to what you're talking about, when I've taught this text in the past, I do a paratext analysis. So paratext is just any, for those who might not know, is a term by Gerard Jeannette. It's just any parts of a text that are not the text itself proper, but introduce us to the text or frame the text. So like that's the title, that's the cover, that's the back blurb, the copyright page, dedication, anything like that, a author's note, that's a paratext.
Yep.
So I always start this novel with introducing the concept of paratext and doing a paratext analysis. And I have had students look at the map, which is why I was asking you. And I actually had to refresh my memory on what kinds of things they've said in the past from just my notes of past classes. And one thing about the map is that it's from a sort of bird's eye or almost godlike perspective, right? But then within the map, you also have details that are important to the dogs. And then you also have, and for example, I mean something like the Garden of Death, where some of the dogs are poisoned at. You actually have that marked on the map, on this map from a bird's eye view. Then you also have elements of the map that are human sort of elements or related to human, like the streets. You know, street names are not as relevant to the dogs or the gods, but they're here on the map. So the map right from the start sort of functions as this troubling of the human god dog divide by putting all the concerns of all three together on one map. So the map itself becomes this paratext that almost gives a sense of the competing but also overlaid perspectives that are in this novel and how all of the perspectives are brought together. You know, you can't separate what the gods do from what the dogs do, because the gods obviously are causing what the dogs do. You also can't separate the life of the humans from the life of the dogs, because the dogs are caught up in the human life going on around them as well.
That is actually awesome, and I might steal that from you. About because the map, like, I don't really focus on it, but that's a really good way of looking at it. Definitely.
Yeah, I was just thinking of it in terms of space and place. We have a map starting out the beginning, and even the Dramatis Canes, actually, there's a list. So again, for readers who are listeners that might not know, there's a list at the very beginning of the book that lists out the dogs, and it's the Dramatis Canes instead of the Dramatis Personae. And in that list, you actually see what kinds of dogs they are, but I've never gone that second step. Like, you know, each of the breeds are listed. I've never gone that step that you've gone and ask students to then take that paratext and fill in sort of information or bring in information about the dogs in the real world, because that would provide a whole nother layer of reading the book through the lens of real world dog biology, I guess.
Real world dog biology.
I'm not sure what this, I don't know science. Do you have any other ideas or concepts that you focus
on
when you teach?
Well, I was looking at one of the things we did was I brought up the tried and true Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which worked really well for the summer course because, I mean, this is the first time I did it. I didn't do it with the first years at USASC because it didn't cross my mind. And I know the more I teach this novel, the more stuff is going to come up for me to teach. And even just talking to you, I'm like, oh, hey, that's a great idea. But most of the students in this summer class were in human services, the human services program. So they were becoming social workers or going into mental health or whatever. So bringing up Maslow's hierarchy was really, was great because they were already familiar with the concept.
So what do you say about the book through Maslow's hierarchy? I think I can guess, but what kind of...
Well,
what
we start out with the basic needs, right? And if we look at this in human terms, from Maslow's hierarchy, we have our basic needs, right? Such as we need shelter, food, we need safety, right? Those are our basic needs have to be met. And these dogs, and before we can even move up in this hierarchy, these needs have to be met. And so these dogs are meeting these needs. We're wondering, can these dogs actually make it to the point where they move up that hierarchy and self-actualize, right? To find that self-actualization. And I think probably Prince is the one that comes the closest, even though in the end, his story is just heartbreaking.
So it seems like that's kind of a model you're using to explain why some of the dogs behave in the way they do. Like if they don't have the sort of lower levels of the pyramid met, then that can cause them to do X or Y.
I think that there's some of them that just wanted to stay in the lower levels of the pyramid.
Gotcha. So it's more a desire thing. It's not being forced to.
No. They have to, they've got this higher order of thinking, and I think it's the dogs who embrace the idea of this complex thinking who are able to move up. Whereas the dogs who, I'm trying to think of a word that I don't use when I'm writing, the dogs that reject this higher order are the ones that are willing to stay, they want to live in the park or they're looking for food and safety in the pack itself, right? Because we have Frick and Frack with Atticus. And I mean, and once again, and I'm thinking about this and I anthropomorphize them too, because I see Frick and Frack as these two, those two crappy guys in high school that always bullied everyone, and Atticus, you can see, he's older, he's wiser, but he's a bully himself too, mm-hmm. even though he doesn't, I don't know. I guess it's hard to explain. Now I'm thinking about this more and I'm like, wow, there's so much more to get into with this novel. Holy moly.
And actually now that we've said this word a few times and it just occurred to me, like anthropomorphizing, okay, how do I say? Anthropomorphizing characters that have already, that are animals, but have already had human intelligence thrust upon them. That seems like it's its own kind of complicated thing. Like they are already inherently anthropomorphized because that's part of the book, right? The book has said, literally, it says human intelligence or mm-hmm. human consciousness has been bestowed on them. So we're actually talking about animals who, and characters who like are already almost pre-anthropomorphized. So it's like the book is kind of doing that work for us as readers. It is already doing that anthropomorphizing work.
I think, yeah, okay. You know what? That's a really good point. But, well, not but. I think the problem is what we've done is I didn't do it. I'm not Apollo or Hermes. But what they've done is they've taken these animals, it is complicated. These animals that we tend to anthropomorphize anyhow, right? Mm-hmm. For example, most of these dogs have human names.
Yeah.
Right? So you take these dogs that humans already anthropomorphize, and then, like you said, is basically give them a double whammy, and now they are, in a sense, human. Mm-hmm. In a sense, right? Just furry and four-legged, but
We have an entire storyline in this book, a huge one, where Majnun becomes like intimately involved with a human to such a degree that she says essentially that Majnun is equal to her human partner, Miguel. Yeah. So we do have dogs that are basically operating at the level of the human already. And what you're saying reminds me of one of the things I wanted to say in the way that I've experienced students responding to this text, which is that because dogs in particular are not just any old animal to a lot of people, dogs are not just any, they are such a beloved pet, a beloved kind of animal for so many folks, certainly not for all. That seems to make, for my students a lot of the time, this an especially hard read. Like, it's not like this is 15 fleas or 15...
Yeah. 15 cockroaches.
Exactly. I mean, there's a reason, I think, why Alexis is drawing on this beloved figure of the yep. dog. I do have a lot of students who resist some of the things going on in the book because of their beloved feelings for dogs, such as when the dogs use the word bitch, which to them in the text is just a neutral term to describe, or it seems to be a neutral term to describe, the
female
dogs. And then also I've had students sort of reject and really respond with disgust in some ways to the sex scenes where the dog is sort of watching humans have sex, and also mm-hmm. to the mounting and the politics around mounting in the text. So it's interesting that this beloved figure, this sort of held up animal, is being used in these ways that really push back at the idea that dogs are merely innocent, that dogs are always good dogs,
exactly,
good boys.
You're not always a good doggo. Yeah.
It's really troubling that, but the way it's troubling that is by saying the gods have interfered. So I'm not sure if in the end there is a lot of complication of this. It's not like saying these are 15 actual dogs that I'm complicating in this text. These are 15 dogs that have been touched by the gods, which makes their behavior a little bit different. But certainly there's still dogs who, watch two people have sex and have opinions on that, who mount and who murder. These dogs are murdering one another.
They're murderers. Well, Benji's that guy that you don't lend money to, because you'll never see him again. I mean, that's the thing about this dog. He's a manipulator. Very much a manipulative dog. And in the end, when he meets his demise, the students, they felt bad for him, but not as bad as they did for the other two, the two that everybody felt the worst for.
Yeah, I think so. I think Majnun and Prince really gain a lot of sympathy, of course, and they are. Sort of seen as ethical behaviors for the most part throughout the text. But then Benji's quite sketchy. He has self-interested motivations. He wants money because he figures out that money is important in the human world. So he starts asking humans for it. And I just remember that scene. I don't even know what page it is, but he's like, money. And it spells it out. And he doesn't know what he's saying yet, but he knows that it's important to the human world. So yeah, there's certain dogs that garner our sympathies in stronger ways than the others, which complicates again the ideal vision of the dog or the narrative of the good dog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, you have to think about Benji. I mean, if it wasn't for Benji and that, the Garden of Death, right? He's not a good dog. And even when those dogs died, I felt, even though they were the dogs that wanted to stick to the old ways, there was still this, feeling of sadness, because they were dogs that just wanted to be dogs, and they were just doing their dog, trying to live their dog life. Right?
That's actually so true. It's like Atticus.
Atticus actually hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. And even in the way I teach Atticus as kind of the warning story or the cautionary tale or the fable, because I don't know if I've mentioned this, but this is called 15 Dogs and Apologue, by the way. So it's it includes a moral. It's a moral fable. So Atticus, I'll often teach as like, not as the villain, but certainly as the character who serves as a kind of cautionary tale that delivers the lesson, which is that you can't just stick to what's seen as natural or authentic or normal. And you certainly can't enforce ideas about what is natural, because that can get into very violent territory when you start to do that. Because Atticus says, we're only speaking in the way that's natural for dogs, and we're only going to behave in the way that's natural for dogs. And it's really a larger lesson about the damages of trying to enforce this obviously way more complicated idea of what's natural behavior. We see that play out in the human world all the time, that being a problem, of course. Yeah.
And what's interesting is it's actually, and I read one article, I remember when I was doing some research, because I was frantically trying to come up with ideas for this course, right? Mm-hmm. Because like I said, I'd only taught it from a TA point of view or a TA, but the idea that, what Alexis is really doing here is looking at diversity, and we had a brief discussion about that, especially since these were human services students, is the idea of, diversity in Canada. All these dogs are different. They all have different motivations. They're all different, we'd say breeds, but they're all dogs, right? And I don't know, like we had, I can't remember exactly what we talked about, but we talked about that as well. Yeah. And we actually, you know, the idea of accepting something new, staying with the old, we have that issue in Canada all the time. You know, there's, and we see this across the country, you know, we have to accept the new, are we going to accept the new ways, or are we going to stay stagnant? You know, I don't know. It was, like I said, it was one class, because these are 3-hour classes, so you have to fill them up as best you can. Yeah.
I think the novel is trying to go for something like that, totally, where it's like the pull of the old and how that can be dangerous, and then the pull of the new. And actually, the main thing, or the main text I introduce beside this text, is Plato's Allegory of the Cave.
Oh, nice.
I think, I have a feeling you'll know so much more about this than I do. So I teach it through essentially a video, which I'll link to in the show notes. And it's a simplifying but still very enriching video depiction, cartoon depiction of Plato's Allegory.
I probably used it. I think.
Oh, really? I use it every time. Yeah. It's just, I find it to be a pretty good, pretty accurate, and while simplified, still quite rich depiction of Plato's Allegory of the Cave. And so I show this video, which again, I'll link to in the show notes. And I talk about, so the allegory is essentially Plato's theory of reality and of life and of education. And in short and very simplified, it's essentially, for those who don't know, it's an allegory that suggests that we, or some humans, are like prisoners chained in a cave, sort of watching the wall of the cave, and all they can see because of their chains are the shadows that appear on the wall of the cave. And they think that that's reality, and that's all that reality is, because they can't turn around and they can't really see any of the actual objects behind them making the shadows. Then finally, the one prisoner is released and goes out into the goes outside of the cave and is introduced to actual objects, things that are not shadows. And finally, the sun, which, first of all, causes some distress because the pain of the light in his eyes, the light of the sun, is jarring after all of these years being in the dark cave watching shadows, but also is sort of illuminating to the prisoner, who sees the sun and sees that the sun is what makes the shadows, and the shadows that the prisoner has always thought is reality are actually made by this sun that he never knew existed. Then when the prisoner returns to the cave and is like, hey guys, I
guess what?
Yeah, guess what? There's more than this. Not only does he find it hard to go back to the cave and see the shadows in the same way, the fellow prisoners who are still chained up find it hard to understand his view. So that's a big simplification of what's actually going on there.
A good way to look at it. Absolutely. Yes.
This is totally what's happening in the book, because we have these dogs who are immediately granted human consciousness. They are thrust out of the cave. They start to see things in new ways. And somebody like Atticus, who says no ways but dog ways, wants to run back into the cave and also, more problematically, convince every other dog that they too must run back into the cave. And Plato's theory is also something I introduce in order to complicate. You know, I say in my lessons about, you know, Atticus actually, and the theory itself, the allegory of the cave, shows why it can be a troubling theory, because who decides who the people in the cave are and who the enlightened people are, the enlightened philosophers, who decides what is real knowledge and what is shadows? I mean, the book really engages with that question when it shows us Atticus trying to force other dogs to only speak in the original dog language, only mount according to the original mounting rules, and sort of obey the usual cave rules of dog life, right? Yep. And then we see other dogs who have exited the cave or been forced out from the cave, sort of negotiating that light, the sunlight, you might say, new knowledge in different ways and struggling with it in the same way that in the allegory of the cave, you know, the prisoner's eyes sort of are distressed from the sun or are taxed from the sun, because it is a painful experience to realize that new knowledge or a new perspective is to take on a new perspective or to have new knowledge sort of thrust upon you. But again, it's not a theory without its problems. I just think that it applies so well and so richly to this text. And so that's where I actually, that's what I usually focus on. I focus on the old ways and the new ways when I teach this text. And actually, usually students come up with a whole list of old ways versus new ways as they discuss, as they term them in the novel. And then we go from there into the Plato video, the allegory of the cave cartoon. We talk about how that applies to the old ways versus new ways. And then in the end, we usually bring it back to Atticus because he's such a, like I said, a good example of the ways that the allegory can sort of authorize really harmful behavior on behalf of individuals who think their way of seeing is the only way. I am the one who's out of the cave and you are not out of the cave. You're still in the cave. So you have to agree with me, right? And he really... Mm-hmm. wants the dogs to be on his same side or in his same perspective. So we usually end with Atticus and talking about how he provides some of the moral of the story.
That's really actually interesting because the final class that I did last time is we did a debate. And so which side we have, old ways, new ways, which is better? Or which and the student, of course, like in a class of 24, these were big groups because I only did two groups. Mm-hmm. But it was really interesting that everybody got involved. And the debate was so lively. And I really like that you brought Plato into that. That would be a really good teaching to have them read the allegory of the cave and to debate through thinking about the way you just explained it. You know, just because the dogs, you can even look at them for a metaphor for like human beings, right? There's some people, like I said, that just don't want to change. Nothing is going to change their minds. Even though I went to university and I have all these degrees, do you think I could change my dad's mind about certain things, right? and you know, I could, you know, we're seeing this right now in real time in politics, you know, and you know how much I love my politics. but we see this, that there's, you know, just these people that, you know, they're in the cave. There's other people who are enlightened, or they like to think they're enlightened, and they're trying so hard to change people's minds about things. But I think we see this in human form as well as in this dog form, and that's, you know, that's what I got my students to do. They had to bring up text evidence, you know, certain things that happened, and then they had to rebut each other as well, you know, like saying, "Oh, the dog way or the new ways are better." Oh, yeah, but well, look what happens to this dog. Look what happened. Who says this is better? Right? How is this better?
That's hugely complicated in the novel. It's not clear cut. Even though Atticus can look like the villain who dedicated to the old ways is bad, it's mm-hmm. not that the old ways are bad. They actually see dogs that haven't been touched by the gods frolicking about enjoying mm-hmm. their lives, right? So your exercise, your debate really speaks to both what I was just talking about with the allegory of the cave and also to the novel's really complicated morality. It's complicated mm-hmm. message on morality, on ethics, on knowledge, on neither of those two ways that you're talking about necessarily being always better, right? Because we mm-hmm. see dogs being unhappy across the board and
just like humans.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and that's where I think, again, that anthropomorphizing thing comes in, because they are sort of acting as humans in this text because they have been given human intelligence. So they're not acting as the dogs that they see around them that haven't been touched by the gods. Yeah, so it's hard to treat them as just dogs. So you kind of went into methods already, or at least the debate, which is great. But what challenges, or have you had any real challenges in your teaching of this text?
Challenges mostly is just to try and find, like I said, the first time I was a TA, the second time I was doing this as quickly as possible, like putting this together mm-hmm. as quickly as possible. So a lot of what you've said has actually helped me to start thinking a little deeper about this. Getting them to recognize the challenges I had.
First of all, if I can just stop you there, even what you just said is so important, because I think one thing that I hope to highlight on this podcast and hopefully will continue coming up is how the actual real pressures of our teaching and working lives, meaning precarious labor, how quickly we're hired for a class that we have to develop in 2 seconds, mm-hmm. how low our wages often are, and that will impact how well we can teach. All of that is a real challenge. So I just wanted to pause here to say, yes, that is a challenge in teaching this text and a lot of texts, which is that mm-hmm. the pressures of TAing, which means making money, trying to be financially stable, getting hired precariously as sessional lecturers, also similarly pressured, all of those things are going to shape the way that we're able to teach text. And I hope that I really just want that to keep coming up. If it does, that would be great, because it's something that needs to be emphasized. Current teaching practices are overwhelmingly shaped by the kinds of material, physical, and financial realities that we have to negotiate.
I totally agree. And then there's also the problem with the student evaluation, you know, mm-hmm. Which I mean, I want my student evaluations, but a lot of times I feel that I am planning around, oh my God, I don't want to bore them. Oh, I don't want them. You know, I want this to be interesting.
Oh, and that takes so much more labor to think about, not just education and goals and having good teaching moments, but also keeping things fresh, keeping things interesting. Yep. Of course, that's more labor. And again, it can be tempting to slip into complacency, but when your livelihood depends on it, you know that not only for yourself, because you think it's important, but mm-hmm. for the students and for your livelihood, you need to make this entertaining, make this fresh, make this a good lesson. Yeah,
exactly. But what else did I find difficult with it? I don't know. There's the obvious problem. The first time I read the novel, back in Saskatoon when I was teaching, I cried constantly through the last third of the novel from, you know, Majnoun's 5 years, right? Of, you know, and it's really interesting that he's the one who's most deeply affected by time, right? Mm-hmm. He's the one that discovers time in the first place, realizes that time is happening. But then he's also got this, you know, like then his vigil.
Yeah. He waits for, did you say, I couldn't even remember the details, but he waits for Neera, who he doesn't know has died in a car accident, but maybe we don't know.
As far as I can tell, it was a car accident on their way home from their little trip.
Yeah. And he doesn't know that she's died. So dutifully as her sort of partner in life, dog partner, and as she is sort of like his master, I think he says that a couple of times, mm-hmm. he waits for her for 5+ years until a god comes and collects him. I can't remember if it's Apollo or Hermes, but comes and tells him to please stop waiting and sort of brings him into death. So are you saying the challenge is the emotional heft of this novel?
The emotional challenges. I have huge emotional challenges with this novel from the very beginning, right? From the very mm-hmm. beginning, there was like, you know, a little bit choking up. But by the end, by the last, like I said, the third, where we deal with Majnoun's vigil to Prince's death, to the end, I was like, I remember I was sitting on my bed in my apartment and in my bedroom and finishing this up because I had to come up with some kind of lesson plan, and I was just done. And then when I came in, and actually the students were supposed to be finished that next Friday. And I walked in and I looked at them all and I was like, so who's finished the novel? And all of a sudden you just see these faces fall. And I was like, I can tell who's finished the novel. Cause, you know, so that's the biggest challenge I have, because then when I taught it again, I thought, okay, well, I'll do 15 dogs. I've done it before. It's Canadian. I wanted something Canadian, cause I was trying to, you know, I don't want to just stick in my Brit lit world of dead poets, right? And, you know, playwrights. I'm trying to, it's good for me. So I thought 15 dogs, it's great. Okay, we'll do this. And then when I was reading it again, you know, I was like, oh, for goodness sake, why did I do this to myself? You know, and
I had that written as a similar challenge. I said, you know, I personally, I don't know if I have cried during, I will have to remember if I've cried during reading this, but what I do know is that students have come to me, have whispered in class, have emailed me about how emotional this was. So I do see that as something to think about as an educator for the future, not to prevent me from teaching it, but how do we shape the learning experience that we can talk about how our emotions will inflect our readings too, right?
That's actually interesting, because I gave a lot of warnings. Like I gave trigger warning, okay, watch out, you guys, this is what we're about to do. But I think it would be interesting, especially when I was teaching the ones who walk away, because that it involves humans. And there's, you know, quite a few stories, you know, and then, like I said, I did Heart of Darkness as humans, but the idea of what it means to be human, we have complete meltdowns, or many of us have complete meltdowns about this story, whereas we can dry eye our way through stories where, you know, human propensity to commit violence on other humans, we're not crying. I mean, we might be horrified, but we're not, you know, my students hated Heart of Darkness. every student, well, not all students hate it. They start to understand that this is, you know, it's essential to recognize this, you know, this vile world. And then what I do is I pair that with Apocalypse Now. After we read Heart of Darkness, we watch Apocalypse Now. But nobody's really, in Apocalypse Now, for example, I don't know if you've ever seen it.
Yeah, I actually have taught it alongside Heart of Darkness, which it's funny that you say all the kids, you're like, oh, should this ever be taught again? And I feel like I have similar feelings where maybe no, but I taught it for almost a whole year, actually, with when I was co-teaching with Len Finley. We taught that text and another text over the course of an entire year, Heart of Darkness for a year. So it really...
Heart of Darkness.
Yeah, it's the emotional aspect that we're talking about right now of reading is certainly there when you're persistently returning to this text about atrocities and colonialism, right?
But do we cry about it? That's the thing that really bothers me, or not bothers me, but what I'm recognizing here is that, you know, everybody's a blubbering mess reading 15 Dogs, whereas we can sit there and watch Apocalypse Now. And this is really interesting when we watched it in class this spring before the lockdown, right? And we had to go remote. I actually managed to get through Apocalypse Now, which was great. The only time students were gasping was when the puppy on the boat, the little puppy, and when the water buffalo gets slaughtered at the end. That's the only time I saw any kind of complete reaction. And I talked to them about that, like complete, like horror reaction was the animals. Mm-hmm. And I asked them about that afterwards when we had our question and answer time. And I'm like, I noticed this, like, what's wrong with you guys? You know, we didn't say what's wrong with you guys, but they, you know, everybody was saying that, you know, it's animals. Mm-hmm.
I know that there's tons of work done on that sort of social or societal impulse to be emotional about depictions of animal abuse, violence, mm-hmm. or death on screen, but not likewise the same with humans. And I'm sure this is probably a huge scholarly sort of rabbit hole that we could go down if we wanted, but it's a troubling impulse, as you're pointing out, to be like, oh no, that dog died, but not to meet with equal horror the violence of colonialism, let's say, if you're talking about Heart of Darkness. Or
so that's pretty much the difficulties. There you go.
Any last things you wanted to mention about this text?
Should read it, honestly. I think everybody needs a good cry. I think it's proper to draw parallels between what these dogs value and what humans value. I think that's, you know, like we were talking about through the majority of this, is how, you know, the old and the new. And also about how maybe this novel, I don't know, this sounds a little, I don't know, hippie, but maybe this novel will make us kinder. I don't know.
Aww.
The empathy. I do. To like start to recognize human empathy for other humans as well, you know, and maybe everybody just be nice to dogs. That's all I have to say.
I think that's a very good place to end. So I'll just say thank you so much for coming on and talking to me about this novel. I realize it's been a while since you taught it, so I appreciate that you responded with such generosity to my request.
Oh, well, thank you. No, I love it. And
thank you so much to Tara for coming on the podcast to chat with me about Teachin' 15 Dogs. It was so lovely to exchange ideas about a text that we both teach from different angles and to learn from that exchange, and I think probably bring that learning into the next time that I teach this text. This episode was recorded on Treaty 6 territory and the homeland of the Métis, where, at this time of recording, in the week before this episode will be released, there is crucial work being done toward prisoner rights and prisoner justice in Saskatchewan, a province and inside a country marked by the violent over-incarceration of Indigenous people. Central to the work being done here in Saskatoon is Corey Charles Cardinal, a prisoner justice advocate who organized a hunger strike that incarcerated people across Saskatchewan took part in this month to protest the government's gross mishandling of COVID-19 protocols and outbreaks in Saskatchewan prisons. Cardinal wrote a piece for Briar Patch magazine, which I'm going to link to in the show notes, and it contextualizes the hunger strike he organized within, as he writes, a quote,
154-year-long campaign to diminish the identities of Aboriginal warriors as protectors of our people, end quote. There's also an open letter in solidarity with Saskatchewan prisoners, which looks like it will be sent out before this episode airs. But I'm going to link to information about the letter and also a list of actions you can take to stand in solidarity with incarcerated people in Saskatchewan and to contribute to the organizing and the activism that Cardinal and others have been doing for prisoner justice on Treaty 6 and beyond. Thank you to Diella Swain for the podcast music. You can find more of their work at soundcloud.com/DiellaS. That's DiellaS. Thank you to Jade McDougall at muskrat-hands.com for the awesome podcast graphics. You know that you can follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at teachinbookspod, or you can also get in touch via email at teachinbookspod@gmail.com. You can use the hashtag teachinbookspod to talk about the podcast. And thank you to Kira for using that hashtag, my book club friend Kira, on Twitter. It is a new year, and I would love it so much if you would very kindly rate and review the podcast, especially if you like it, on Apple Podcasts especially, or on any podcatcher that allows you to do so. Okay, listeners, goodbye for now, but please join me again next week on Teachin' Books, no G. That felt too short, but I will probably forever be changing my sign-off because it turns out that I'm extremely indecisive. So for now, bye!